Yeah, happy Mother's Day to all the mums out there, and happy Mother's Day to my mum, Sandy, as well. It's time for the news.
98.9 FM News.
The Shadow Minister for Indigenous Affairs has slammed the government for isolating a portion of Indigenous Business Australia's funds for use on other services. The government's 2016-17 budget handed down this week shows the government are to pull just over $23 million from IBA to fund their own initiatives. The budget says the funds will be used in business planning and advice services and workshops and training for Indigenous entrepreneurs. Labor's Indigenous Affairs spokesperson says he can't understand why the funds are being taken away. A co-chair of the National Congress of Australia's First Peoples says he doesn't think the budget will help to address the high rates of incarceration of Indigenous people. The comments come in response to a reduction of nearly 6% of First Nations legal services around the country, with funding cuts due to begin in July 2017, with additional increases each year following. Speaking to ABC Radio National, co-chair Rod Little says the budget doesn't go far enough in addressing key issues such as employment and incarceration.
Our friends from family violence centres, they certainly are feeling the effects of this budget. There's no certainty about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community legal services. I guess the other impact is on mainstream community legal services as well. It's not a real good deal, and we feel for those organisations.
The federal government has confirmed that all the $171 million in funding announced in the budget for the Great Barrier Reef has come from other environmental programs. It was further revealed that a large portion of the funds will not be available for use on the reef until 2019, which coincides with when UNISECO is scheduled to reconsider whether the reef is categorised as in danger. $101 million of the money will be taken from the National Land Care Program, while the other $70 million comes from a capping of programs within the Green Army. Green Senator Larissa Waters says that along with the $100 million announced for the mining exploration, the move was an indictment of the government. Sport and weather after the break.
It's amazing how powerful a piece of paper can be on election day. At this year's federal election, the way you vote for the Senate has changed, and it's important that you understand how to vote correctly. On the white Senate ballot paper, you'll now need to number at least 6 boxes above the line, or at least 12 boxes below the line. This election, your vote will help shape Australia. To learn more, visit aec.gov.au or call 1-3-2-3-2-6.
Program sponsor.
I watched Pop die. Lung cancer. From smoking. My sis and Uncle Barry have trouble breathing. I was smoking. For years too. But I quit. Because I don't want our kids growing up thinking disease and dying like that is normal. If I can do it, I reckon we all can.
Download My Quit Buddy from the App Store. And together, we can break the chain. Authorised by the Australian Government, Canberra. Spoken by E. Crombie and G. Summers.
Program sponsor.
The National Indigenous Radio Service.
The voices of our people.
Listen online, live, at
www.radio.nirs.org.au.
Sport now with Sean Binley.
Kangaroo forward Sam Fidey says Greg Inglis is ready to fire for the Kangaroos when they meet New Zealand in Friday night's Anzac Test in Newcastle. Inglis has been under all sorts of pressure as his Rabbitohs side struggle to find form in the NRL, with the fullback accused, amongst other things, of trying too hard. Fidey, who's played alongside the Dungarty man for Queensland and Australia for over a decade, says he's happy for the media to put the spotlight on the Rabbitohs skipper, who invariably saves his best footy for just such occasions.
I'd love for you to keep on talking about him and keep on bringing him down, because every time that that happens, he ends up playing a great game. So please write some bad stories about him. I'm looking forward to seeing how he's going to react out on the field.
And that's the latest in news and sport. To stay up to date with Nurse News, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or visit our website at nirs.org.au. And now for a look at today's capital city weather forecast. 25 and sunny in Sydney, a partly cloudy day in Melbourne with a top of 23, 28 and mostly sunny in Brisbane, showers and possible late storms in Perth with a top of 21, 23 and partly cloudy in Adelaide, a shower or two in Hobart with a top of 18, a sunny day in Canberra with a top of 23, and 33 and possible shower in Darwin. And that's the latest National Indigenous News.
Welcome to Let's Talk, Brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning. Welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people all across the country and around the world, actually. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the nation via the National Indigenous Radio Service, or if you're listening on our website 989fm.com.au or on our podcast a little bit later, welcome to you as well. And the reason I said around the world is because we've sort of got an international perspective right in the studio this morning. Looking at earlier this week, we spoke to a young climate change warrior, Amelia Telford, who's from Tweed Heads, a Bundjalung and South Sea Islander woman. Today we've also got Larissa Baldwin, who's also Bundjalung, in the studio today, also talking about seed, but we also have a guest from Turtle Island, and I might get him to explain where Turtle Island is. Joseph White Eye is a 20-year-old warrior himself from his own traditional lands, and they're here just before they go down to Newcastle, actually, to protest a big coal. They're going to take part in a big coal facility blockade down there. So I really appreciate them coming in this morning before they make the long 11-hour drive down to Newcastle. How are you this morning?
I'm good. Thanks for having us.
Joseph, can I ask you first, what's your traditional country? Where are you from?
My traditional country is Turtle Island, also known as the United States of America. I'm a Lakota from central South Dakota, and I come from the ninth largest reservation.
Wow.
In the United States.
So describe your reservation for us. You grew up there?
Yeah, it's... pretty alienated, nothing but plains for miles and miles on end. You can go up on top of a hill and you can see just everything, and it's real beautiful. We have two rivers that border us. We have about 21 communities on our reservation, and our reservation size is 2.7 million acres.
Wow. Yeah. So growing up, you had a very strong connection to your country.
No, not really. You know, of course, I grew up in an alcoholic family. Drug abuse was constantly there and everything like that. But I was fortunate enough to have a grandmother that was really strong in tradition. And so I would always go over to her house, and, you know, she basically raised me since I was a baby. So.
Learn a lot of the old stories. I guess there'd be a lot of similarities to communities over here, would you say, Larissa? Because we obviously have similar histories of invasion and colonization.
Yeah, we've been sharing so many stories, even to, like, you know, life on reservations, but just, like, even a lot of the stuff that happens in community, there's a lot of similarities with his mob. So, yeah, it's been cool to share a story.
Tell us a bit about your country.
So I'm a Bundjalung woman from Widjibal Clan, and my country is all rainforest, hinterland, beaches. I grew up in country down on the north coast of New South Wales, and all my mob is like the Roberts mob down there, so biggest mob.
Yeah. You're now a regular guest, I'm hoping, on this show. Hopefully our listeners become more acquainted with you. Joseph, you mentioned your grandmother. I mean, was it her, I guess, who instilled a lot of this love of country and that connection, that continuing connection? Because I think even here, particularly in areas, you know, I grew up in sort of an urbanized setting, a lot of that connection is lost. Was it sort of your through your grandmother that you were able to sort of revive that?
Yeah, my grandmother, you know, she practiced a lot of our ceremonies back home, and you know, I really took that into myself just because, you know, I wanted to know who I was, I wanted to know where I was from, and I wanted to know, you know, who my people were. So,
yeah. And you were only very young. You're only 20 now. But when you started to get involved with this, it was very young, weren't you?
Yeah. I was 14 years of age when I started doing a lot of more environmental stuff, as well as cultural revitalization and language revitalization back home.
And what was the reasons that you began that? Problems start to happen on your land, obviously. I mean, why did that spark that interest for you?
Well, I also grew up with an organization. They call themselves the Cheyenne River Youth Project. You know, they brought in volunteers and different experiences from off the reservation, as they would usually bring in international volunteers to expose us to the outside world and stuff like that. And I really kind of took that into my heart, you know, because they offered so much to me and I just wanted to give back to my community and the other youth as well.
Yeah, right. And what are you doing over in Australia? How long have you been here?
I've been here since Friday, and I came for the SEED, Indigenous Youth Climate Summit, right?
Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about SEED.
So we just had our largest summit for SEED. We had 77 young mob from all over the country. We had people from all through the Northern Territory, Tiwi Islands, like every state and territory represented. We came together for a national summit where we launched a campaign called Protect Country.
Yeah.
And it's just about getting out and talking to our mob about the impacts of climate change, but also understanding and trying to get people to work together. So yeah. Understanding there are people on the forefront of extraction, but also climate impacts. And as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, we're stronger together. So get out, talking to our communities and getting them connected on the issue. We also did an action calling on Malcolm Turnbull to stop the subsidies to new fossil fuel projects. So
yeah.
We know that they're trying to open up 90% of the Northern Territory is under gas exploration license. So.
Yeah.
Speaking out about that, we've been working with a lot of mobs across NT.
And it's only, I mean, even though obviously these problems around mining and development have been continual in our communities, I guess it's only recently that we have a mobilisation of young people around the country who are actually starting to actively stand up against these pro-development, aren't we?
Yeah, totally. I think it's also, we've been fed the lie for so long that this is going to be the economic development, this is going to be the saviour for our communities, and I think people are really starting to work out that it doesn't work like that. We don't see the royalties from mining.
Yeah.
There's a lot of risk involved for our communities, and especially, you know, you look at WA and in the Northern Territory, like the rents are going up so high, people are being left homeless. Like, it's not the saviour, and people really are starting to get sick of it. And, you know, there are a lot of mob out there dealing with compulsory acquisition of their land because they're saying no to it. So the only way that we can kind of support them is to just go back them and let people know what's happening around the country. And when people know that Indigenous land is being forcefully taken, they get outraged. So it's our job to get out there and tell people what's happening.
You've been doing this for 6 years, Joseph. Is it, I mean, obviously, so it's a much longer time, isn't it? Do you see key differences in the way the fight has sort of carried out between your peoples and over here?
The only difference is that my people back home, we have a treaty, and you know, the United States has to recognize us as a sovereign nation, as opposed to here. You know, what I've heard is that the First Nations Aboriginal people were sent to missions, and they really weren't, you know, given the opportunity for self-governance and self-determination, and a lot of it's kind of on their own. And so we have the support from our tribal government back home, as well as a lot of other big greens, I like to call them, I guess. But.
Yeah, you have more of a sense of empowerment, whereas over here we're still having debates over whether Australia was settled or invaded, aren't we, Larissa? It's just amazing.
Yeah, people get offended because we changed the word to invasion, which it was.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I've been talking to Brother Joe for so long over the last week just about the treaty and that sort of stuff, just picking his brain, but I wish we had a treaty.
Yeah.
Like, it would make such a difference. It's just, it's the way that they can use their treaty. Like, it's not perfect, but they have a lot of ways to challenge stuff that happens on country and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I wish we had something like that.
Does it shock you to find out we don't have a treaty over here, Joseph? I guess because it's been sort of, I mean, it was, you know, part of your life for so long.
No, it wasn't too shocking, just because, you know, I know how the non-Indigenous people work, and, you know, a lot of similarities happened between us, and it doesn't surprise me that, you know, they didn't even offer the First Nations people of Australia anything at all.
So. Yeah. We don't even have it on the political agenda right now either, which is a really sad thing. Can you tell us a little bit about your protest actions, how you're standing up to big development?
I guess one of the big things that I was really able to take part of was the Keystone Pipeline campaign and all of that. You know, we set up teepees on the mall in Washington, D.C., so right in front of the Capitol building to let them know that, you know, we were still alive and we're still here and we're still defending our rights as Indigenous people of the land. And, you know, with the Keystone Pipeline that really unified our people as a whole, because in one of the treaties, and it was one of the illegal treaties, it's Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868, and that divided us from one larger reservation into nine smaller reservations in the state of South Dakota. And, you know, that was just one of their tactics to, you know, divide and conquer us.
Yes.
And so during this campaign, you know, a lot of the tribes that really didn't step up in a lot of our fights really took the lead, and they led the people. And, you know, we set up multiple camps on three or four other reservations back home. And, you know, it really created a strong unity amongst us.
So. Yeah, right. So what are those camps called? I think you were telling me a little bit before.
The spirit camps.
Spirit camps.
Yeah. Spirit camps. I guess it would be similar to what the Indigenous people of Australia had, embassies, I believe.
Right.
They were embassy camps. But only thing is, you know, it's we try to keep ceremony there and prayer there and, you know, try to keep the political point out of it.
Right.
Just so that... you know, we can use a culture against the federal government, and if they try to, you know, do anything, you know, we'll have kind of a
way to, and you live in one of those camps actually now.
Yeah, we currently have a camp set up against the Dakota Access Pipeline, which is another pipeline that will be running underneath our main source of water, and the river is called the Missouri River. And they're only going to dig about 40 feet under, and it's, you know, when it comes to oil pipelines, it's not about if the pipeline's going to spill, it's about when it's going to spill.
Yeah, and that affects not only, you know, waterways, I can imagine, are so essential to your life source as well, wouldn't it be? I mean, it's a matter of life or death, I guess.
Yeah, in our language we have a saying called Mini Wichoni, meaning water is life.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of our ceremonies, you know, water is our first medicine, you know, it's our first healer. And, you know, we're born in water within our mothers, and you know, they carry us for 9 months, they care for us. So, you know, we really take that phrase Mini Wichoni into a really, you know, strong
So what's happening now? They're obviously continuing with this Dakota pipeline. Do you see any way of changing it, or how is the protest movement going now?
So we do a lot of nonviolent direct actions back home, and you know, getting our people prepared for whatever's about to come. So the pipeline was approved in the state of North Dakota to be built. They got the permits and everything, and the Army Corps of Engineers got involved, you know, which is basically the United States Army.
Army are brought in, are they?
Yeah, just because, you know, they own, not really own, but they manage the riverbanks in the area, and the pipeline is going to go under the riverbank. And so they need the permit from the United States Army Corps of Engineers to be able to build that portion of the pipeline. And it's and the pipeline's just going to go across, or right above, no more than a mile from our reservation borders.
So. Right. So when you say non-direct protest, what do you mean by that?
Can you ask?
Like, what do you mean by how are you going to protest it? Blockades or?
Oh, he's telling us about stopping trucks.
So I'm not sure if I, you know, should be able to...
we can't put the tactics out there.
Yeah, for sure.
He's gearing up to protest it.
Yeah.
What do you think of when you hear stuff like this that's happening the world over, Larissa?
I think it's kind of incredible. And it just makes it so much more important to be able to talk to Indigenous brothers and sisters across the world who are standing up in the same fight. Joseph tells this really amazing story about the seventh generation. Do you want to...
Yeah, talk about that.
He tells it better.
So
I can imagine he would.
So one of our war leaders, his name was Tashunka Witko, translated into English means crazy horse. And, you know, back in the 1800s, he was he always led a lot of our battles with the U.S. Cavalry. And every battle he was in, you know, he never lost. And finally, you know, it came a time where his people were hurting, and, you know, he was a real strong warrior at heart, and he would never surrender to the United States government, but his people were hurting, you know, they were tired of running, they were tired of fighting and all this other stuff, you know, and they were starving, of course. And so Crazy Horse was forced to surrender, and, you know, so he went to one of the forts, and at that fort, you know, they locked him up, or they chained him up, and they were going to take him into a prison guardhouse, and, you know, that life wasn't for him, so what he did, you know, he started resisting, and finally one of the U.S. Cavalry, you know, came up behind him and jabbed him in the back and ended up killing him. And before he died, he said the seventh generation was coming, you know, and it's a prophecy, of course. And in the seventh generations, and you know, the world was going to see change when they get here. You know,
yep.
You know, cultural revitalization as well as language revitalization, and you know, they're going to restore the balance of the earth. Yeah. And a lot of our elders back home, as well as our youth and adults, you know, are realizing that the seventh generation is here now.
Wow.
And I'm lucky enough to be a part of that. You're lucky enough to be a part of that. And so is Larissa.
So that's amazing, isn't it, Larissa? We have a real mandate to try it. Because I think I feel so cynical because so often control is taken out of our hands. I mean, when you look at the effects of climate change, you look at particularly just the Great Barrier Reef, the extent of the coral bleaching, and you just think, what can we do? When you hear stories like that, I guess it gives you a bit of inspiration to continue fighting.
Yeah, it totally does. I think it's also I think I get a lot of energy from young activists as well. Like when you're together with a group of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people, you're just like, wow, we actually do have the answers and we are actually really smart. There's so much knowledge in the room about what's going on. And I don't think if you got a group of non-Indigenous young people in this country, like same ages in the group, whether they'd have the kind of understanding of exactly what is happening around the country.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been fighting this struggle and this deficit for so long that I think one of the benefits of it is that we really understand how stuff works.
Yep.
Like you can't not understand how the political system works if you're a black person in this country.
Well, to be Aboriginal, you're pretty much political from birth, aren't you?
Yeah, that's it.
It's very interesting, I guess. We might go for a song. We're here with Joseph White Eyes and Larissa Baldwin. Joseph's from over Turtle Island, a Lakota man, and Larissa Baldwin is a Bundjalung woman. We're talking about climate change from an environmentalism from a Indigenous perspective. Here's Carrie-Anne Cox with Beagle Bay Dreaming.
This is Let's Talk with Amy McQuire.
Good morning and welcome back to Let's Talk, where we have two guests in the studio today, one close to home around Brisbane area, Larissa Baldwin, a Bundjalung woman, and one a bit further from home, Joseph White Eyes. He's come all the way from North Dakota, a Lakota man, a young environmentalist climate change warrior. And they're joining me both in the studio this morning to talk about, I guess, the next actions, both in traditional countries over here, but also over in America. Joseph, I was going to ask you, we've talked a lot about how Aboriginal voices are continually mobilised in Australia, and particularly the broader climate change movement. It's a, sort of a very white way of going about things. Is it similar where you're from?
yeah, it's pretty similar, you know, that, you know, according to whatever census rolls came out back in 2010, you know, we only take up 2% of the entire population in the United States of America. And, yeah, we don't, you know, we're slowly building ourselves up to where we have a voice, you know, and the media is starting to cover us a lot more, and we're really starting to get our issues out there and
yeah.
Be recognized as First Nations people as well. So,
yeah, from an international perspective, I guess coming from here, we don't hear a lot about it, do we, Larissa?
No, I think it...
Not unless you're interested.
It tends to focus on the stuff that comes out of, like, what we call the US, is it focuses on the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
So African-American people... And just the, I guess, acknowledgement that that is Native American land is just so, like, people don't talk about it.
Yeah, we got two very different histories of colonialism and oppression when we consider the differences the way African Americans were brought over to America, but the way, you know, we as Aboriginal people had our land stolen. I mean, there's two different, completely different sets of oppression, really horrendous. Is there any chance that the voice, the Native American voice, will be listened to anytime soon, Joseph, particularly given that the primaries are currently on and America's sort of in the stages, the beginning stages of an election cycle?
Well, when it comes to elections for the United States of America, you know, a lot of Native people really don't have a strong vote, especially in our area. I'm actually from South Dakota, not North Dakota, to correct that. We come from a Republican state, which is really racist, you know, I mean, really prejudiced, you know, they try to keep us, you know, contained under reservations
and yeah,
you know,
right.
They do a lot of, what do you call it now? I can't think of the word right now, but I'll come back to that.
Yeah, so it's still very silenced, I guess, which is very similar to over here, isn't it, Larissa?
Yeah, totally. I think that we're, like, the younger generation over here, young black fellas, is really responsible for this, like, resurgence of, like, getting some issues into the media and that sort of stuff, and that's through protest actions, the old way, as well as using the new way through social media and that sort of stuff. And also, like, a lot of young mob connecting with different Indigenous people right around the world and learning, like, better ways to do things and that sort of thing. But, yeah, it's a complete resurgence of activism.
I guess in America you are up against an even bigger media machine, and when you look at particularly the amount of press that people like Donald Trump and a lot of his racist nonsense has gotten over in America, how do you begin to even fight back against such a huge media machine?
Well, you know, we back home we turn to the grassroots, you know, because the grassroots is where it has to come from in order to really get your voice out there. And I'm really glad that you brought up Donald Trump. I'm just pleased to announce that we are going to be doing something in one of our towns, which he's going to be visiting against him. So we're going to be protesting him, of course. And, you know, Donald Trump has really had nothing good to say about First Nations people when it comes to our sovereignty rights, you know, and a lot of other things as well. So, you know, we're going to take a stance against him, let him know he's not welcome into our traditional territory, and hopefully get rid of him.
Yeah, right. What about, I guess, Democrats who are, I guess, traditionally a little bit more left-leaning, but not really? When you look at people like Bernie Sanders, does that give you any hope from a Native American perspective, or is it going to be more of the same?
Well, to me personally, Bernie is white, you know, and I don't believe he was brought up, you know, really learning who we were except for what he read in the books. And when it goes to the books, you know, our story is not really told at all in the books.
Yeah,
you know?
True.
And so he did hire a Native person to work on Native relation issues for his campaign. And to me as well, you know, I don't believe that our people should be even involved with the United States government just because I'm such a traditionalist. And
yeah,
I believe that's, you know, selling out to my people if you work for non-Natives. Especially in the government.
Well, you're your own nation, aren't you? You have your own sovereign nation. Wouldn't it be great to have something like that over here? Where actually, I was listening to the ABC the other day, and I don't know if she was misquoted, but it was her talking. Marcia Langton, who's a prominent Aboriginal academic over here, was basically talking about we have to give up the cause for sovereignty because it's not realistic. I mean, that's our prominent, one of our prominent Aboriginal academics, basically sovereignty is, you know, we've already ceded it. It's all the way over here, but we never ceded our sovereignty at all.
When did she actually even do that? Her old people didn't do that. I mean, what is she talking about? We never ceded our sovereignty.
Yeah.
And don't speak for anybody else.
No, exactly. And this is the problem. We've got a few debates that are covering over the cause for sovereignty and treaty over here. So, very,
it's pretty
very
funny
sad.
About when I seen it, because I got really mad when I first seen it, and then a bunch of people shared it on my Facebook page, but I was like so tempted to write something, but I wrote something about Best Price, and then it ended up in The Australian, someone talking about something I'd written on my Facebook about Best Price. I was like, I'm going to reserve my comment right now, but I don't agree with what she said.
We have very limited limited space for media discussion over here. I guess, can you tell me a little bit about what happened at SEED? How did you sort of see, you're in a room with a lot of young Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander youth who've sort of come together to start talking about these issues. What sort of feeling did you take back from that room, Joseph?
Well, I was really inspired because, you know, we don't have something like SEED back home, especially, you know, focused on Indigenous youth. And when it comes to you know, a lot of climate talks and environmental talks and cultural talks, of course it's going to have to go to the Indigenous people just because, you know, they were the original caretakers of the land. You know, they understood what, you know, giving to the earth as well as taking from the earth really meant.
Yeah.
And, you know, and also they were a bunch of youth, about 77 of them, I believe. And, you know, when issues like this go to the youth, you know, they're a lot more passionate. They have a lot more energy to really get stuff done. And, you know, they can work long hours and whatever else without feeling, you know, drained and really like the energy's gone. So I really, you know, I'm really inspired by what SEED had to offer. And,
because I guess when you're looking at it, when you look at the effects of climate change, and it's happening right now with and the effects of development, it's happening right now with your pipeline, the most vulnerable are always going to be Aboriginal peoples all across the world. It's just, you know, no argument. It's always going to be the case, whether it's in the Pacific or Indigenous populations in developed nations as well, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. I mean, In a lot of Australians can only see like Pacific islands as frontline communities, but our people are already experiencing the impacts of climate change. It's already impacting the ability to live off the land, to practice ceremony. Being in this space, you have so much more story coming to you about what's happening across the country. One of the things we do at SEED is like, yes, we run campaigns like to protect country, but these campaigns come from our youth, and that's one of the really like empowering things. Like the campaigns that we roll out, the sort of tactics that we do, it all comes from our young people, which is really inspiring to see. And one of the things that we hold as a value is like having these youth in SEED is like, if we're going to give them skills and we're going to give them training, then these skills have to be transferable, because there are a lot of issues happening in our communities. It's not just about climate.
Yeah.
This is just a space to come together that's like a safe space to like build up your confidence and that sort of thing. But yeah, it was an incredible weekend at the summit.
And I guess when you're talking about pipelines particularly, a very similar thing is happening up in the Northern Territory. And last time we spoke to you, Larissa, you were going up to Borroloola. Can you tell me a little bit about what happened up there around the oil pipeline, the gas pipeline that they're hoping to push
through?
Yeah,
so went to Borroloola and then I went to Katherine. We had the largest rally against the pipeline that Katherine had ever, like the largest rally in Katherine ever was. We had TOs from all across the NT. But so in Borroloola, which is in Gulf Country in the Northern Territory, there's the largest deposit of shale gas. And you would have seen somewhere, maybe in California, there was mass evacuations of this county that basically there was a fault and all this gas, and so there's an evacuation. Borroloola is on a fault line as well.
Yeah.
So it's like they want to drill down through the water and put some explosives in there, and like trying to tell the TOs that, oh, your basin, the water there will be okay.
Yeah, yeah.
It won't be.
Well, it's already been contaminated by the MacArthur River mine, and particularly I remember there were stories, one particular nation in that area. I mean, it's the head of the Rainbow Serpent, isn't it? It's the head of the Rainbow Snake. The mine has actually gone in, and there's high lead toxic levels of fish.
They re-diverted that river too.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at water, water is life. I mean, you see it from your perspective, Joseph. It's just, it's so destructive to our very being, isn't it?
Yeah, and then it like to re-divert a river that is so much a part of like their stories and like their dream time and that sort of stuff. I was just like, you guys, like, you, it just makes you want to fight with these boys. So they all came down to the SEED Summit as well and told their stories to the, you know, the SEED crew, and then we were just all like, yeah, we're going to get behind you, and like thinking about all the things that they can do right across the country. That we had the biggest NT crew come to the SEED Summit ever. They're going to do a, they want to go do a road trip down through the pipeline, because a lot of the along the pipeline route is their communities.
Yeah.
So I go with the Borroloola crew and talk to them about the impact on their country, but basically that this pipeline isn't worth it. And they loved hearing Brother Joe's stories because they were just like, yeah, we can stop this pipeline. So,
gives a lot of inspiration,
yeah,
definitely. I'm just interested, Joseph, we also have these arguments. It's almost like a binary argument over development and in, you know, keeping land rights, really, about, you know, well, mining can help give economic development, it can help give jobs, blah blah blah. It's almost just like conflicting arguments. Do you have the same thing over in your countries? Because we do have high profile Aboriginal leaders who say, oh yeah, no, but we have to have a, and I guess there's some truth in that, we have to have a right to build our own communities up. Do you have the same debates, and what do you think of that?
Yeah, we do have some of the same debates. You know, in the beginning of the Keystone Pipeline campaign, you know, a lot of our people were for it and a lot of us were against it. So we're kind of divided right in the middle. And so those of us who oppose it start doing our research on the pipeline. And, you know, when they say it offers jobs, you know, it's, they're not going to offer jobs to the people in the communities. They're going to bring people in from out of state.
Fly in, fly out, yeah.
Yeah, and when they get here, you know, of course, you know, all the drug and alcohol problems are going to really increase. And with the Keystone Pipeline, you know, they have these things called man camps. And in these man camps, it can hold anywhere from 2,000 to about 20,000. Just men who are working on this pipeline.
So you've got outsiders coming into your traditional countries with no sort of consent or anything like that?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, a lot of times in these camps, you know, a lot of sexual assault goes up, both on the men, women, children, and, you know, even elderly folks, you know. And up in Newtown, North Dakota, you know, that's a big oil area, and, you know, everything just rose there that wasn't even supposed to be there.
Yeah, right.
And there's a story of, like, the sheriff's one time, you know, this police officer, she went there, and, you know, she told her story about what was going on, you know, with the sexual assaults and everything, and, you know, she was fired for even speaking out against it, and, And there's a lot more stories that you'd have to look on the
internet. Raising a lot of uncomfortable
truths. Really, really uncomfortable truths.
I don't know if you know much about it, but we've had a lot of people, particularly Canada First Nations people, coming on talking about missing and murdered Aboriginal women. Is that a problem in your traditional countries as well, whereas police are not actually taking a lot of victims seriously because they're Indigenous?
Well, of course, we still have missing, women and missing children and everything, but it because we stopped the Keystone Pipeline, we prevented from anything, major from happening and stuff, so...
Yeah. So it's a bit of a success story there.
Yeah, just a bit.
Yeah. Not too much. Still always, the fight is always on.
Yeah.
What sort of, I guess it's a two-way learning experience as well when we have mob coming from overseas over here. Well, I guess, are there any key lessons you want to take back to your communities over there that you might have learnt from people over here?
I think just not involving our people, the Lakota people, but, start working on a relationship with our traditional enemies, and hopefully bring them in the loop and then work with all our allies in the area and then hopefully expand from there, like Seed has done. They went to all the different states here. And I'm hoping that when I go home, we'll start having these talks to start really uniting not just, a group of Indigenous people, but the entire Indigenous people.
That'd be beautiful. We can make a big network all around the world, I think.
Yeah.
Sure. And I think that's why it's like Seed is a network. And that's one of the reasons like it's called a network, is because recognizing that we're diverse and that people are right around the country and that we're going to do things a bit differently in different spaces, but also that is like our power.
Yeah.
We are diverse, but we can come together on things. And I think it also speaks power to this lie that, there's this disharmony within Aboriginal communities and like people disagree with each other and that sort of stuff. Like, no, we can disagree with people.
We can have a debate. Why is that weird?
Aboriginal people aren't allowed to debate.
We all got to think the same.
When I was in a meeting with Greg Hunt, who's our federal environment minister, and we're talking about something that he'd done that was really dumb and he approved of mine. And he said, well, the traditional owners are in disagreement. I'm like, so white people in this country aren't allowed to disagree on stuff? And he just shut up.
I like to see Greg Hunt speechless. I think that's the best. Can you tell me a little bit? You're getting in the car soon, going to start a big road trip down to Newcastle. Tell me a little bit about that blockade that's going on down there.
Yeah, so we're heading down to Newcastle and we're going to blockade the Newcastle port. And basically, it's an action that's happening right around the world, break free, and it's about breaking free from fossil fuels. And basically, that if we want to, there are these targets agreed to in Paris, and we're not going to make them if we keep, digging up new coal and exporting and burning new coal. So it's like really just kind of a warning shot to governments around the world that people are mobilizing against this, and you do need to keep your commitments. And you need to transition to clean and renewable energy,
definitely,
but also more sustainable jobs as well.
We were talking to Millie Telford earlier this week about Seed's climate change position to reduce, fossil fuel subsidies. I was just reading $6 billion or something in fuel subsidies to these industries.
$7.7 billion. Yeah.
That is a lot of money, isn't it? When you consider, put it up against how much Aboriginal Affairs is funded and we're continually given peanuts, really.
And the thing about subsidies is like, coal is in a structural decline right now. We're in an oversupply with gas. Like, all of these subsidies is dead money. We're not getting anything back in royalties. These companies don't pay tax.
No.
So why are we shelling out all this money?
And they're ruining the earth. It's really disgusting.
Like, people say that we can't, transition. Like, it's going to take time to transition, and we understand that. And, when we talk about mining happening on country, we're not... fighting against Aboriginal. We only support Aboriginal people that are saying no to mines on country.
Yeah.
We're not here to tell our mob all around the country that they can't do what they need to do to get economic development. We understand the issues around disadvantage and that sort of stuff. But, $7.7 billion is, you could start so many sustainable industries. Like, there are so many sustainable teaching, doctors, all of these things are sustainable jobs.
Yeah. And New South Wales particularly, they have just passed really harsh anti-protest laws down there, haven't they? You a bit worried about that?
I'm not worried about it, but I'm still going to keep doing what I'm doing.
Last year it was quite a big protest, wasn't it? People, mob got in canoes and rode out there and basically blockaded the water,
didn't
they?
Yeah, so last year we had, we were there in support of the Pacific Climate Warriors, who were just a bunch of young people throughout the islands who were standing up and saying, like, our islands are being, you know, we've got the ocean washing into our house. One of those stories that was just, like, got me there was, like, there was this young person from Kiribati and was saying, like, they were going around talking to communities and, like, what do you do when these massive king tides come, because they've changed, they're, like, 5 metres higher than what they used to be. And he said that all he can do is, like, tie his family together, and if they get washed away, they're going to get washed away together.
Yeah.
And it's just like, this is so real for people. It's not an issue. It's, you know, people make it an environmental issue.
No, it's happening right now.
It's a human issue.
We're right on the cusp of having our first climate change refugees.
Yeah.
And then look how we treat refugees in this country. I mean, I think we have a lot to be ashamed of in this country. We might just go to a break now. We'll listen to a bit of Christine Arnua, Torres Strait Islander woman. I'm here with Joseph White Eyes and Larissa Baldwin, who are joining me in the studio this morning. Good morning and welcome back to Lex Talker. I'm joined in the studio by Joseph White Eyes, a Lakota man from over Dakota, South Dakota. Sorry, I got your country wrong. Sorry about that. And Larissa Baldwin, a Bundjalung woman. Now, Larissa, we were talking a bit before about the McArthur River mine, which has been going on for 30 or something years. It's absolutely been so disgraceful. Tell me a little bit about what's happening now. There's a few planned protests.
Yeah, so
worldwide protests.
The mine belongs to Glencore. And it has been burning like the rock up there. They haven't covered it up properly, and there's a lot of pollution in the river. So a lot of there's four clan groups in and around Borroloola. They're coming down to Sydney on the 19th of May to Glencore head office. It's like at 9 in the morning. But basically what's happening is Glencore is having their AGM over in Sweden, and there are a bunch of solidarity actions for the McArthur River mob.
Yeah,
that are happening around the world.
Yeah,
talking about what Glencore has done to their country, because
so it's not just in Australia. Obviously,
there's stuff happening in Sweden, South Africa, just Indigenous mobs around the country, around the world, standing up for them and saying like this is happening on their country, and hopefully getting some cut through in the media about what Glencore's doing.
Yeah,
because basically Glencore needs to pay for the damage that they've done to their. To their country,
yeah,
and also they're asking for independent testing of their water and that sort of stuff.
Oh, definitely,
because
it's a continuing disgrace. I mean, even the rehabilitation is going to take very long, even if they can rehabilitate it. Really,
I think one of the really important reasons to understand why you need to back the mob from Borroloola is they got stuffed over with their native title claim, because Borroloola was going for the native title at the same time that this McArthur River mine was like. You know, going to expansion.
It was
that
actually
sort of
going to be the first case, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it was. And then they had, because of like this is a great economic thing that was going to happen for the territory, the mob up there got no veto rights over the mine. Yeah. So they have no right to say what can happen to the mine. They've did a couple of actions up there where it's just like reclaiming sacred territory, which is like doing big walk ons with their community and that sort of stuff, and saying this is our land and this is we're protecting this space because it's, you know, sacred sites and that sort of stuff. But they really do need a lot of support, and we need to get people connected about what's happening up there.
And I guess where can people go if they want to find out
so
about
we,
being able to support these mob?
Push a lot of stuff out for Borroloola because we work with them against their pipeline campaign and the fracking campaign that is also happening on their country. So if you go to seedmob.org.au and if you sign up to get notifications, we'll send out a bunch of stuff that's happening for the Borroloola mob around the country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what other sort of actions are Seed planning in the future?
So at the moment we've got a petition up, so seedmob.org.au/protectcountry. And basically what we're doing is getting Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to sign up and just say why. Basically we're asking Malcolm Turnbull to stop putting subsidies into these big projects, which is the new coal and gas ones, and a thing to kind of know about these projects is these are ones that traditional owners are saying no to.
Yep.
So by saying you don't want the subsidies and really calling Malcolm Turnbull on what he's doing, putting all this money into these new projects, supporting traditional owners to say that we don't want this business on country and that
definitely.
We're standing up with traditional owners to say no.
And we'll put a lot of our information up on our website. Joseph, if people want to go and find out more about your fight, where would be the best place to go?
Facebook. You know, we have a couple pages. Of course, the page that I help monitor is One Mind Youth Movement.
Yeah.
And then the Indigenous Environmental Network.
And that Indigenous Environmental Network, you said you don't have anything like Seed across is this completely sort of a different thing? It's mostly just concentrated in your reservation?
No, it's concentrated on a lot of environmental issues in First Nations countries.
Yeah, that's great. So we'll put up a lot of those details
as well.
Yeah, that's
Indigenous Environmental Network. I said it's an notification. The amount of stuff that comes up that's happening right across the country is like...
Yeah, definitely. I, for one, would love to keep updated about it and learn about sort of like force backs across the nation, across the world, you know. I think it's important to have those alliances, and it's great to have them in the studio today. We've got two sitting here right now. And I really appreciate you both coming in this morning. I just wanted to change topic for the last about 4 minutes of our conversation today, and it's about, and I think we're talking about this with Joseph, it's about a really troubling case that happened in Barrowville. Down near Nambucca Heads, it's a small community, a long history of segregation, obviously, the oppression felt across a lot of New South Wales Aboriginal communities. But in 1990 to 1991, three Aboriginal kids, Colleen Walker, who was 16, Evelyn Greenup, who was 4, and Clinton Speedy-Jura, who was 16, all were murdered on the same stretch of mission, same stretch of street that ran through the mission. And for 26 years, these families have been fighting for justice. The original police investigation bungled it. It was sort of hindered by all these huge unconscious racial biases. But the reason that these kids have never had a proper day in court has been because of the racism that affects us all across this nation. And yesterday I went down and joined the families in a protest action outside New South Wales Parliament House. And again, the hurt is just like it happened yesterday. When you talk to a lot of these families, it's like they just lost their children yesterday. And they had yet another setback where Labor and the Liberals down in New South Wales were talking about the anti-protest laws down there. So they have no problem playing around with civil liberties when it affects white people, but when it comes to Aboriginal children, they won't even hear about it. They won't even look at sort of weakening what they say is weakening the double jeopardy provision to get this man before court. It's really sad that these kids are still fighting. It says that, you know, the lives of Aboriginal children don't matter, Larissa.
I think it's so sad. And, you know, you and me just talking about it, I had goosebumps, but yeah, watching it all unfold, I was so hopeful that something was going to come yesterday after all the promises that the New South Wales government had made. But, it makes you angry as well.
Yeah.
Because it's like, where's the outrage?
Yeah.
And I know for Aboriginal people especially, like, have really, like, amplified their voice over the last 2 years, like, we need to retry this case. And, like, the evidence is all there that the police completely bungled it. Like, it seems just so black and white.
Yeah.
But, and to me, like, I don't want to take anything away, but at the same time, you know, when Daniel Morcombe went missing, everybody was up in arms. Like, that was everybody's child, you know. And, you know, they got to the point where they, like, found his body. Like, they went on this campaign for 7 years and it was relentless. And it was, like, the whole of Australia. But it's, like,
everyone
it's
knew their
kid.
Name. It was a household name. Whereas Colleen, Clinton and Evelyn, just, like, they were forgotten.
Yeah.
And it needs to change. There needs to be an opportunity to heal. And this accused has to go to court again.
Yeah.
And then let the justice system deal with it again. Yeah. But at least get him before court and give them the opportunity to heal.
Yeah, I think that's a thing. They're not asking for, like, the sentence or anything. Like, they're just asking for a day in court.
Yeah.
And the police are the people that have bungled it. It's just crap.
Yeah, and it's funny because now the police are on their side. They did a completely different second investigation headed by Gary Jubelin, who some of you might know. They devoted a whole underbelly series to him, so he's a good cop. So he's actually gone in, and he was sitting there with the families yesterday in Parliament House, and he's been supporting them. He's looked into it. He said there's only one man accused of these crimes. When you look at all the evidence, it's all, you know, very strong circumstantial evidence that wasn't previously admitted into court. So they need to get their day in court. And join us next week because we'll be doing a couple of specials around Barrowville on Let's Talk. For now, thank you so much, Larissa and Joseph, for joining us today. I really appreciate it. And Joseph, I hope we can keep in contact because maybe we can update a lot of our listeners about what you're doing over there, because obviously it's a very long fight. And if you want to find out more about SEED, we'll put it up on our website, but it's also seedmob.org.au.
Yep.
Go to our website, 989fm.com.au, and listen to our podcast a little bit later. If you want to stay updated or share it around. Hope you have a good weekend.
This is Let's Talk with Amy McQuire.